This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
We now have just under 20 minutes for discussion of the very different sorts of management of very different sorts of long-term conditions that we've heard. And this is your chance, since it is a masterclass, to get to the nitty-gritty of how to actually do it, if there's anything you want to know from the speakers. It is being recorded again, so we do have a roving mic again. Anything anybody would like to ask any of the speakers? Yes, over here.
Thank you very much. I'm Louise Restrett, the NHS London Respiratory Lead. I actually wanted to ask John and Gillian about, you both talked about behaviour change in your clinicians, which I completely agree is really, really important in moving the agenda of working with patients forward. And I just really wanted to know how much you felt that for the Tower Hamlets work, you were able to get so much traction because you'd had the Year of Care programme, because I think both the Year of Care and the co-creating health models really help clinicians change how they work with patients. And I wanted to ask Gillian how you were going to bring about the activated clinician part of your work, because my understanding of it, expert patient at the moment, is you don't have that access.
John, do you want to?
I'll go first, if you like. So, yeah, I think just in relation to the organisational development and the transformational change that we saw as a result of that, I think that was absolutely critical in relation to that element of it. And that was split into two components. One was around some generic OD that we did across the board that we actively encouraged everybody to participate in. And in a way, that really gave us the building blocks, really, for then individual networks to identify what their bespoke OD requirements would be. But your specific point about Year of Care, I think, yeah, absolutely critical. I think if you were to look in more detail at that very busy slide, you will see that actually the practices that were in the networks that were part of the Year of Care pilot were the ones that actually were performing as good as the Wave 1 networks in relation to there. So it gave them a really good solid bedrock to start that. So, and again, it supported us, I think, in some of the conversations about developing the more detailed care package, in the fact that we'd already embedded some of that methodology from Year of Care into that thinking. So, yeah. That the simple answer is critical, I think.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to start by taking a step back. Traditionally, expert patients, as you rightly identified, was a programme that dealt with the patient rather than the rest of the service. Through the co-creating health experience, we know that the best results are when you have a patient who is engaged in self-management and empowered to self-manage, but also when you have a clinician that understands what that patient's empowerment to self-manage is. So actually, currently, the Expert Patients Programme are working with a number of PCTs across the country to look at developing programmes that link directly to buddying up almost the patient training and the clinician training, and building that into a service design, which probably looks closer to what John was talking about in terms of looking at all elements of the service. And that's not just COPD, but it's actually across the full range of long-term conditions. And actually the clinician element, you can pretty much drop any long-term condition in through very little change to make that relevant for whatever service that you were looking at, and that's available now. So
that suggests you'd be looking at providing the same kind of training that co-creating
very similar to the same very similar to
for patients and clinicians.
Absolutely. But I think it's important that no two service needs are the same, so it's important that rather than just say we can deliver to you an example that looks like co-creating health, that we would actually be prepared to sit down with you and look at what the absolute need in that area is. So I mean, if I was to reflect that into some of the boroughs in London, for example, it may be that the need is to look at some of the more vulnerable or difficult to reach communities. And that would require a different approach to just you doing a standard co-creating health model, for example.
I think the only thing just to add is we're currently doing some joint work with public health, specifically looking at the impact that we think that self-care, care planning element have, particularly in terms of the increased uptake around screening and around that element, and then the more longer-term health benefits that might bring as a result of the impact in relation to there. And that's only just beginning to start, but early findings of that are beginning to produce some really interesting results.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Yes, there's a gentleman here.
Thank you. All the presentations were really thoroughly interesting. Can I just ask the question from a community pharmacy perspective again? My name's Hithin Patel. I'm the chair of Ealing Hammersmith Hounslow LPC. We talked about integration of clinicians. First question is, in terms of percentages, how frequently were community pharmacy integrated into this particular various models? If you look at it in terms of pharmacist and the patient relationship, the pharmacist, community pharmacist actually sees the patient more often than the GP does. And I think in that particular example with Dr. Ahmed gave, it'll be interesting to see if that was repeated with community pharmacists being integrated in the model. And I think we're missing a trick here. And I'm sorry to labor on the point, but I think community pharmacy do need to be playing a further part and a major part in the future.
Would you like to comment on that, Dr. Ahmed? We'll send the mic over.
It's just a six-month pilot, and it's rolling into kind of the next phase. And we are sort of learning from, you know, shortcomings or mistakes or whatever you want to call it. We need more engagement with the patients as well. And one of the ideas is around using sort of community pharmacy to take up the no smoking campaign, integrate that better, and also medicines management, but also use patient groups more, which we haven't done so far. So, yeah, I mean, in the next sort of 6 months, things will get more aligned. Yeah.
Louise, you wanted to comment on that? Would you wait for the mic?
I just wondered if I could respond from the NHS London respiratory team point of view. I completely identify with what you're saying. We have four priority work streams, and it's lovely work that you were presenting. Our priority work streams are that stopping smoking is the treatment for COPD, and we would see community pharmacists having a key role there, that getting patients into pulmonary rehab, and I want to follow on with a question to the team, is absolutely critical if you're going to reduce bed days. Our two other work streams are called responsible respiratory prescribing, and I suspect most people in this room won't realise that per item, the respiratory section of the BNF is the most expensive cost. So the average respiratory cost for any item you prescribe, if you think about the inhalers, you might think they cost £1 or £2, is £17. It's higher than cardiovascular, it's higher than neurology. And so it's actually really important that there is an enormous amount of waste of inhalers in cupboards not being used, being duplicated, patients not getting them into their lungs. And some of our work is a QIP work stream that we very much are doing with Helen Marlowe and working with community pharmacists, looking at reducing the inappropriate prescribing. And I think my take on your model of prescribing might be slightly different, and of the same thing for oxygen, responsible prescribing for oxygen, which was a community pharmacy responsibility but isn't now.
And did you say there was a question that you had for them?
Yes,
about?
Yes, I just wanted to ask, so really interesting seeing your cost, your savings data, but I've got two questions. First of all, what made the contributions to that? What was your pulmonary rehab uptake completion and contribution? How did you do on your quit smoking prevalence? Really nice to see your focus on smoking. And can you tell us about the costs as well? Because I would suspect with your focus on a medicine approach, your costs will have gone up. And I think whenever we look at savings, we need to look at what you've spent both in delivering pulmonary rehab and in the prescribing costs.
If you wait for the mic. Thanks.
I'll take up the question about pulmonary rehab. As I mentioned before, we had 50% completion rate. And we sort of we did involve a graduate mental health worker in the second phase of pulmonary rehab, but it was slightly later because we were learning as we were going on with this pilot and sort of introducing things as we came along it, and therefore it didn't really achieve it. It was better than the first time around, but it didn't achieve the ideal saving. We had 16 to begin with, 8 completed the first round. We had 15 the second round, and about 9 achieved at the end. So it was better percentage-wise, but you know, it's small figures we're looking at, though. Regarding the medicine cost, obviously as something that we haven't looked at, but when we looked at the data, we had to be very critical in terms of the inpatient admissions and so on, and we looked at the same number of months and the time of the year in the past and compared it with this year. The thing was that this year was the worst winter in 30 years, so you would have anticipated a higher increase, and there wasn't. So clearly we're doing something right, but yes, it's
really interesting data. I just think when we're talking about systems, which is what the whole focus has been about today, then we need to include all of the costs in the pathway, and that's particularly important for commissioners when they're looking at what they're going to commission. It isn't just about the hospital costs, it's the prescribing costs, it's the social care costs.
And there's another question just behind, gentleman just behind.
It sort of follows on from that, really. The work that was done when there was a modernisation agency still in the NHS around COPD looked at various things, and it found that 40% of the hospital bed days were accounted for by people in the last year or two of their life. And actually having a link to palliative care is often one of the things that actually makes a patient journey a lot worse than it should be. And it's something that I think is really important to always include in the COPD. The other things that patients have always said that they really value is things like Breathe Easy and a buddying system to break that cycle of sort of getting anxious at night, etc., ending up in A&E when you might not have done if you had a friend down the road, etc. About the costs as well, I think it brings up a really interesting commissioning issue where, you know, it's fine for a pilot if Astra are paying for the respiratory nurses and whatever, but that is a significant cost in a service if it's going across a PCT. And I think it has to be done, you know, in an organised manner. I think also having the teleconferences, I can't imagine that St Helier's or St George's will forever be happy to do that for free. Eventually, there will be a commissioning cost to that, and it's in the white paper about having access to electronic referrals, etc. So, I think we have to be a bit careful about looking at the costs and the savings for these things, because I think that there are other costs involved in that. But I do think it's classically the one disease area where we are not very good at in London. As you say, we've got a really long way to go, so I think it's a really important one to focus on. But I think, as you say, so many of the long-term conditions have the same risk factors, and actually getting people to stop smoking, lose weight, do exercise, you have to set it up so that you can then do the same sort of work with your cardiac patients, with your renal patients, with your diabetics, because it would be ridiculous if we end up with these sort of silos of patients having the same advice for slightly different diseases, and half of them probably have three or four diseases anyway.
Could you, perhaps if you want to pass the mic over there, could you see a way that this could be done more broadly outside the pilot?
First of all, just to comment back on your points, absolutely the cost per head of running a teleconference is potentially going to be expensive if you're going to run it across the whole of the PCT. But really what we wanted to demonstrate was it was around communication and better linked up communication across the whole of the health economy will help matters. And in fact, we had the consent of the chief exec of the Acute Trust recognising the fact that potentially she may be losing income, but recognising for the greater good of the whole health economy, it was better to manage more patients in a primary care setting. To address the costs of the actual medicines, I guess we had the conversations with the commissioners, and they were accepting that potentially prescribing costs may rise to a point, but the overall costs, because the cost per day of an admission is significantly more, to the order of 10 more, than the cost of a medicine. So I think we have to take the more of a holistic approach, accepting definitely we should buy in more to community pharmacy and get the wastage. But where applicable, if we can prevent that disease progression, because every time a patient exacerbates, their lung function deteriorates. So thinking of the model of care for casa permanente, we want to stop that high-end treatment.
Now, I know that Louise wants to come back in. Is there anyone else who wanted to comment first since you've had a while? Yeah, there's somebody there.
George Woodman from from Commissioning Support for London. We've just seen four examples of innovative best practice. In the era of GP-led commissioning, how do you anticipate disseminating this best practice and getting adoption more widely than your own particular area where you've initiated it?
That's a very good question. Let me ask you to start coming along here.
Okay. Well, we're doing it in a very, obviously, something in a very small, highly complex group, but a very high cost group. And we're already looking at disseminating that. You know, we're in conversations with adult colleagues about the home ventilation for adults and chronic respiratory failure. There's a lot more adults who are failing to wean as well, who are stuck in hospital. And looking at other long-term conditions where we can use the same sort of software processing to help the decision making and the timeframes. We're looking at long-term conditions. I've got a grant from it's a regional innovation fund from NHS London. I don't know if that's going to continue next year. And I've also applied for a Clark Round 3 application. And through the Regional Innovation Fund, we're very fortunate in having Paul Corrigan as a mentor, who's got a lot of experience, and he's, you know, he spent 3 hours with me last week, and we're looking at applying this to other conditions. We've got a big meeting next month when we've got people from Department of Health and John Oldham's team as well coming to apply this, because as Paul Corrigan, who's got a huge amount of his experience in government and healthcare and is also involved in GP commissioning, says if you can do it for this group, you can do it for a lot of other groups. And if you can, and the thing that he said is illogical is, you assume that if you're doing better quality care, it's going to cost more. And having some cases that can prove that's not the case is very useful, I think. So we are sort of actively trying to, and we've got a GP Darcy fellow from Northwest London who's involved in that as well. So we're trying to engage as much as we can with different stakeholders.
And are you able to disseminate yours, or Gillian, or you?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question, because I think what we tend to see at these kind of events is some people doing some extraordinarily good work, and then we all kind of sit and wonder, well, how do we get a bit of that? From the expert patient's point of view, we have really changed our approach to delivering programmes, from delivering programmes directly to the patient, to delivering programmes that fit with whatever the PCT actually needs to deliver in terms of self-management. So for some PCTs, that still is a generic self-management programme that's a catch-all for long-term conditions. For other PCTs, it's focusing on specific conditions, whether they be mental health, COPD, diabetes, etc. And then it is building in that additional programme, looking at, I keep saying clinicians, but I really ought to say healthcare professionals, because I think it's important that the programmes that we're looking at actually catch everyone that patient may interact with. And one of the interesting things, picking up from a question earlier, is looking at pharmacy, because actually the expert patients program very early on was able to demonstrate that patients moved away from seeking the advice of their GP to seeking the advice of a retail pharmacist. So the increased access to retail pharmacy led to a reduction in their turning up with the GPs for an emergency appointment. So actually, when we look at the clinician arm of our training programs, we're actually looking at including everybody that sees a patient on that patient journey. So that could be the hospital at point of diagnosis, through to the GP, through to community nurses, through to hospital specialist nurses, through to hospital pharmacy, retail pharmacy, and really trying to include the whole team, because it's only by doing that you get maximum benefit. And if we're going to try and reduce some of the very high-end costs, we're going to need to catch everybody and the patient and the carer.
Well, that's a very good note to end on there. Well, I feel sorry for Dr. Pennywoods because she spent her time sitting in traffic jams when she, and missed a very interesting session there. But so we have break time again now. Remember to carry on filling in the evaluation forms in your guide. There's refreshments again back in the gallery hall in the next session. There's some really good, interesting speakers in the next session. Starts at 4:25. Thanks very much, and thank you very much to all our speakers.